Let's get started. This, of course, is a consequential parsha for us, especially Parsha Lach, reference, of course, to the Meraglim. But of all the different topics, someone told me they thought it was going to be a Lashon Hara or other such things, Eretz Yisrael. I actually wanted to speak about something which is, I think, very interesting and could be perhaps potentially sensitive as well, and that is the question of eligibility of counting towards the minyan. Now, there are two facets which are well known, which I will not be discussing, which is gender and age. We know that to be counted as a minyan, that would be very controversial if I was going to speak about those. But no, not that exciting. So yes, we take for granted in this year that to count for a minyan has to be over bar mitzvah and does have to be male. However, the question which I want to discuss is, are there any religious requirements? Is it possible that you could be the right age and the right gender and yet still not count towards a minyan? Are there religious requirements to count towards a minyan? And I want to just begin with an introduction of where do we know this idea of minyan to begin with? And that's the connection to this week's parsha, surprisingly enough. There's a Gemara both in Masechta Brachos as well as in Masechta Megillah here in the top source on your sheet from the Megillah, where the Mishnah talks about how Dvarim Shebikdusha, as it's termed, like Kriyas HaTorah and Duchening Birkas Kohanim, which we spoke about 2 weeks ago, and other such things, as we're all familiar, Ein Pachos Me'asara, says the Mishnah. Can't have less than 10, need a minyan. So the Gemara asks on the second line of source number 1, Menah Nimili, how do we know this? Where do you get this from? So the Gemara says, well, in Parshas Emor, it says, V'nikdash v'besoch b'nei Yisrael. You should make a public Kiddush Hashem, not just privately, but it should be v'besoch b'nei Yisrael, and that is at least 10 people. The Gemara says, third line, my mashma, where'd you get that from? I could have read that pasuk 100 times. It doesn't say anything about 10. So the Gemara says, you're right, it's actually not that simple. It's more convoluted, perhaps you could say. The Tani Rabbi Chia, Asya Toch Toch. We know that one of the 13 hermeneutic principles, Rabbi Yishmael's rules of derivation of Torah Shebaal Peh, one of them is what's called Gzer Shava. If you have two areas of halacha, two psukim, which have a common word, even though ostensibly the psukim don't seem to have a connection, they may not be next to each other, but the common word connects them and teaches one to the other. So in this pasuk about creating a Kiddush Hashem with a minyan, it used the word toch, nikdashti v'toch b'nei Yisrael. But where else does it come on in? Where else does it say the word toch? So we have it later on in Sefer HaMidbar, also a bad story with Korach, he badlu mitoch ha'eda. Separate yourself mitoch ha'eda. So, well, that wasn't necessarily 10 people. Where we still don't have 10. But we went, it's a hop, a skip, and a jump. We went toch, toch. Please, come on in. The toch, the original toch from our parsha, from Parshas Emor, excuse me, to the toch in Bamidbar Perek Tezayin. And then in that pasuk, in Tezayin, he badlu mitocha eida, the third word there was eida. So that's the hop, skip, and the jump, finally to Parsha Shlach. There's a second Zer Shava. It's a double Zer Shava. It's a double move. Right? Eida, Eida. Tchsiv Hasam in our Parsha. Ad Mosai le'Eida Hara Azo. It's a very poignant and well-known tragic pasuk from our Parsha. Ad Mosai le'Eida Hara Azo. So the Eida from our Parsha connects to the Eida in Perek Tezayin. Those two Eidas then give us the connection to the word Toch. Toch gives a connection back to Parsha's Emor. And therefore we know that from our Parsha, how many bad Meraglim were there? 10 bad Meraglim. Eida, Eida, Toch, Toch gets us all the way back to Kriyas HaTorah, Kaddish, Kedusha, etc. Malahalan Asara, Achkan Asara. So this is, you know, Gemara, hermeneutics, the Limudim of Rabbi Joel, par excellence. You can't find a better exemplar of that as Gemara. I wouldn't call it irrational, but I think you have to be honest and call it irrational. No one could honestly say that you look at this and this is compelling on its face. Clearly we have an example, which we have throughout the Talmud, of a Mesorah. Chazal clearly had a Mesorah. They had a tradition that Minyan was 10. And they had a tradition that the way it's hinted at and alluded to in the Pasuk are these things. The bottom line is, most posts, I think, if not all, are explicit anyway. The whole concept of Minyan is only rabbinic. Because all the things that you're doing minyan for are anyway virtually rabbinic. But certainly the idea of requiring a minyan, tefillah certainly, is only rabbinic. So it's an asmachta, and clearly there was this tradition of Chazal. What's interesting is I didn't put it on the sheet, but there's a very famous comment of Rabbeinu Bachaye, Rabbi Bachai, of course, one of the medieval commentaries on the Torah, and Rabbi Bachai in Emor, in Vayikra, there in Perek Chav Bet in Vayikra, he is unwilling to accept the Gemara at face value. You're not a heretic if you feel that way. You could be like Rabbi Bachai. Rabbi Bachai says, Hayi Tachin, the source of Dover Shebe Kedusha is going to be the Meraglim. It's confounding. And therefore he says it must be a mistake, a corrupted text. You cannot take this Gemara. He rewrites this Gemara. What gave him the petach? Even Rabbeinu Bachai can't do everything he wants. So how did he pull the rabbit out of the hat? As he pointed out, there's another tradition. It's in a Medrash, and it's also in the Talmud Yerushalmi. And you'll tell me if you think this is much better, but it certainly is an improvement. Here, the Gemara, the second source on your sheet, also looks for the source of Minyan, of 10, and tells us, Toch Toch. Okay, well, that sounds familiar, Toch Toch. But instead of going to the Eda Eda of the Meraglim, here the Gemara satisfies itself with a pasuk from the end, towards the end of Sefer Bereishis. Vayavo b'nei Yisrael lishpor bar b'toch haba'im. Who's that? Who's the b'nei Yisrael? It's not a colloquialism for all of us. It's literally the children of Yaakov. Now, which children? This is when they came down to do some business in Egypt. How many brothers came down? 10. Yosef was already there. Binyamin was little baby Binyamin. 10 brothers came down, so says the Gemara. Matocha amur lahalan asara. Avkan asara. You see the Darbar Shebe Kedusha, Toch b'nei Yisrael, and the Kiddush Hashem, Toch, the 10 brothers. So says Rabbeinu Bachai, here you have the Achim HaTzadikim, the Shiftei Ka. Now, the truth is, this is before they've had their confrontation with Yosef, before he's forgiven them. It's not Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron.
It's not the Meraglim.
Yeah. But, exactly, but it's clearly not the Meraglim. They are the Shiftei Ka. And it's interesting that Rabbeinu Bachai is so convinced this has to be correct, he just can't deal with the Gemara as we have it. Yet, the consensus is certainly the standard posuk. If you take any Gemara off the shelf, no one rewrote our Gemara because of Rabbeinu Bachai's objections. And I start with this because his level of discomfort is pointing out a certain tension, which is what I want to explore now halachically, which is, be that as it may, whatever the source is, to what extent are we looking at who's making up our minyan? Let's say you had a modern example of one of the Meraglim. I don't mean because of Eretz Yisrael per se. I mean a Rasha, an Avarian, a sinner, a heretic even. Right? 9 men and the heretic. Can a person such as that count towards a minyan? Exactly the tension that Rabbeinu Bachai is fueled by, after all, to create a quorum to allow us to say a Dover Shebe Kedusha. Are there any standards? That's what I want to discuss.
There were really 12 Meraglim, so the 10 excluded the two.
But that's the Eda Hara Hazostar, exactly. So therefore, you would say, some say, of course you see that any sinner can do it. After all, if the source is these 10, so how could you can't be worse than them. Sure enough, take a look. The Shulchan Aruch, look down two sources.
The fellow's coming to Daven.
Who said he's coming to Daven? Maybe he's in the airport and he's waiting for his flight. And you say, no, we're short one. Do you mind standing here?
Right, to be included with us.
That's the question. Can you? That's my question. Your point, if I understood you correctly.
I don't mean it to say he can't be.
That's the question of this year. We'll have to see if the. My question was an open-ended one. Are there any religious standards to allow a person to. I don't mean to join us and say I'm like kicking you out. As some of you may know, there was a time, certainly in Europe, and especially in the early part of the immigration of Jews to America, where there were certain shuls who made it as a red line. You could not be a member of the shul. Certainly not count towards them. You couldn't be a member if you were in Shomer Shabbos. The Glen Avenue Synagogue in Baltimore, the famous shul of Rabbi Schwab, that was one of the big things there. There were many other shuls called Shomrei Shabbos. In every Frum community in America, there was a shul called Shomrei Shabbos. That's the reason why. So I'm not discussing that. I'm not discussing whether we're going to let you daven with us. My question is, if we only have 10, including the non-religious, is the answer maybe Enechanami. Maybe it's okay. So let's start with, I always like to start with the leniencies, with the kulas. And then once I, whet your appetite, then we'll try to rein it back in a little bit. So in all seriousness, in section number 2, we have a few sources which seem to be very permissive, if you will. If you look at the second source, the fourth source on the sheet, but the second source there, we're in section 2 now, It's the Shulchan Aruch, and the Shulchan Aruch is very straightforward. It would seem very matter of fact. Avaryan over al gzeiras hatzibur o sheover avera. Whether he's just flouting a communal norm, you see from this that certainly in the olden days, communities were allowed to make gzeirot, which people had to follow. If you want to live in that community, you got to follow the rules of the community. Right? It's the modern day, the initial yeshuvim. But if someone flouts that, or they flout halacha, says the Shulchan Aruch, what's the din? Im lo niduhu nimne leminyan asara. As long as he hasn't put into nidui. What's nidui? Nidui is the Talmudic term for cherem. As long as he's not in cherem, he can count for a minyan. Now, what is cherem? Cherem does not mean what is not the anything like the poor incarnation that we are familiar with. You know, people hanging up posters in Me'er Sharim, or Amap Shemesh, or the like. Say he's in cherem, which, as I heard from Rabbi Dr. Abraham Twersky many times, the best thing ever to help him sell his books was when they put him in cherem. Each time they put him in cherem, he sells another 1,000 books. He wishes they would put him in cherem more often. I heard that from him with my own ears. He's been put in cherem more than once. It's the best thing ever happened to him. This is a joke, unfortunately. And every time they put out another person in cherem, they make it into a bigger joke, unfortunately. But the cherem in not only the time of Chazal, the cherem in the time of the Rishonim was something very different. It was considered very serious. People were literally scared that their life would be cut short because of the ominous nature of having been put into cherem. But it was like almost cosmic. It wasn't just social. It was very serious. So if a person has been put in that kind of nidui, totally separate from the tzibur, so how can they be mitztaref to the tzibur to count as the 10? Says Shulchan Aruch, if you're a nidui, you're out. But let's not focus on that. Let's focus on the humongous leniency here. Short of that, an avaryan with no distinctions, you're totally permitted. You count. No problem to count for the minyan. Sure enough, look at the Mishnah Berurah in the next source. Afilu, excuse me, please. Afilu ave. Oh, good. Again, that doesn't mean count for the minyan. That means to join us. That means to join us. That what we say in Kol Nidre is not, first of all, it's not halachic. But second of all, that didn't mean from what we say in Kol Nidre to daven with the avaryanim. Does not mean that they count as the only, if there's only 10. That's a separate issue. You understand? It's not just about joining us. It's about whether they count towards the 10. But says the Mishnah Berurah, Shulchan Aruch seems to say yes. Mishnah Berurah says, you shouldn't think that we're just talking about someone who forgot to say Kiddush Levana, you know, or maybe I once forgot Alamichia, I'm so tired. No, says the Mishnah Berurah, Afilu Avera Shechayev Alav Misa. Even if a person did a capital offense, they can still count towards the minyan. And Avaryan counts towards the minyan. The source of all of this is from the Beis Yosef, if you go back, where the number two is, from the Sefer HaManhig. And the Manhig quotes a tradition that goes all the way back to Sefer Yehoshua. One of the villains of Sefer Yehoshua, of course, is Achan. Who is Achan? Who remembers? Who knows their Tanakh? I'm not going to ask the men, it's not fair. Of course, right? Achan, of course, is the one, right? All of a sudden, they fight their second battle after the miraculous victory in Jericho. And what happens in the second battle? They take heavy losses. How could it be? So Hashem tells you should just know there is a sinner amongst you. Chata Yisrael. And it's a reference, of course, to Achan, who had taken from the booty. He taken from the spoils of Jericho against the world. Rashi adds, as quoted here, that it was perhaps on Shabbos, so he was also carried. He did Hotzah. He was Machal Shabbos. And yet, when Hashem gives this ominous pronouncement, he refers to it as Chata Yisrael. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin, it's all quoted here in the Beis Yosef, says, why is it called Chata Yisrael? To teach us the famous rule, Yisrael, Afal Pisha Chata. Yisrael who? This is the source. It goes from Achan. He's referred to obliquely as Israel to teach us this long, this very far-reaching principle. That once a Jew, always a Jew, and therefore since you're still obligated in the mitzvos, you wouldn't say because you're a sinner you don't have to daven anymore. Since you're still obligated, you're still part of the community, Yisrael who? It says Shulchan Aruch. You see from this, they can even count towards a minyan. Amazing, amazing leniency. So that's our starting point. Our starting point is the default, which I think some people mentioned earlier themselves. The default, which is not just a gut, it's not just an intuition, it's a Shulchan Aruch. Intuition is, the gut is, the starting point is, Avaryan is counts towards the Minyan Asara. But now we pivot to the big but. The poskim, not arguing the Shulchan Aruch, but clarifying the Shulchan Aruch, point out a number of exceptions to this rule. So, for example, if you take a look at the Mishnah Berurah, right there, it says Sifkat Mem Zion. The Mishnah Brura says on the second line, right after he says that even if you're guilty of a capital crime, but then he says on the bottom, someone who's kofir b'torah shebaal peh ein mitzaref l'chodar shebedusha. The Karaim, the Tzedukim, someone who reject, they can accept the Torah shebaktav, but someone who doesn't believe in the koch of the Torah shebaal peh or the koch of the Chachamim is not allowed to participate in the minyan. That's one very important caveat. Not all sinners are created equal in this sense. Some are punished even from that, are removed. But more to the point, for our purposes this evening, take a look at number 3. Another comment of the Mishnah Brura. And here, as I cite for you in number 3, he quotes from an earlier source, a very influential posek, the Prima Gadim. Pei Mem Gimel, the Prima Gadim. Prima Gadim says, Davka Avera Sha'avar L'Te'avon. When the Shulchan Aruch said, yes, any sinner can join our minyan, not only join, more precise, can count towards our minyan, it meant someone who sinned L'Te'avon. How do you want to translate L'Te'avon?
Enjoyed it.
Well, not just that he enjoyed it, but what it has to do with motivation.
Not for an idealism.
L'Te'avon. That is to say, why did I drive on Shabbos? Hey, I'm not a shitanik. It's because I wanted to go to the beach. Why did I watch the game on Shabbos? Because I want to watch the game. That's all. Why did I eat treif? Because it's yummy. It's l'te'avon. It's because you enjoy it. So such a person, we're not sanctioning it, we're not defending it, but such a person still counts towards the minyan. However, says the Mishnah Berurah, aval hachis, afilu l'davar echad. Even if it's a quote-unquote minor thing. He's not waiting between milk and meat. Come on. Show me that in the Torah, Rabbi. It's not. It's Darabanan. I don't believe in it. Bashita. I'm not waiting. Even one thing. But if it's Lahachis, it's somehow a holy war. So then, you're out. You cannot count. Again, it doesn't mean you can't daven. It doesn't mean you can't join us. But it means you can't count towards the 10. Or, says the Prima Gadim, a third now point, a mumar la'avodas galilim, someone who worships Avodah Zarah. And here, it doesn't have to be so principled. It doesn't have to mean that he's a big philosopher. Someone who worships the Avodah Zarah. Out.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, of course.
The first thing that you just talked about, you know, the difference between...
The Te'avon and the Lachis Kosher.
How do we know what's the someone's heart? How do we know? How can I say, oh, he can count, he can't
count? Well, that's an empirical question, and it's fair enough. Sometimes we might not know. And it could be that all things being equal, if we really had no idea, I would say, well, you might as well give a person the benefit of the doubt. But it's very often that we do know, first of all, very often that they're happy to tell you.
Sure.
I know many people who are happy to tell me all about their shitas and, you know, how principled they are. I don't mean going on a witch hunt. I don't think there's any reason to do that. But sometimes there's strong circumstantial evidence, and sometimes there's out of the cat's mouth, so to speak, you know. But if we don't know, then we don't know. And you're right. I'm glad you clarified that.
When the Mishnah Berurah quotes a Prima Gadim, is he accepting this?
Yes, yes. It's a good question. Sometimes, like many people in halacha, sometimes sources are quoted even just for scholarly purposes, but here he doesn't quote anyone who disagrees, although there are those who disagree, but the Shulchan Aruch Mishnah Berurah just quotes this as his source. But basically the Mishnah Berurah is endorsing this. Now there's a fourth thing that's also mentioned here in the Mishnah Berurah, which will make up the basis of most of the rest of tonight's shiur. Because I want to focus now, more narrowing our attention, more like a laser, I want to focus on one very specific thing. And this is, again, still in that number 3. At the end of the first line, he adds another thing. O, l'chalel Shabbos b'farhesia, dino k'akum. Mishnah Berurah invokes a term which I now want to spend some time investigating, analyzing, is someone who violates Shabbos b'farhesia. In public, he's flouting it publicly. Not someone who's, you know, in his in the privacy of his own home, or you know, when he runs away to his country home where no one else knows him. In the community, in public, he publicly desecrates Shabbos. Dino k'akum. Now that doesn't mean that he's really not Jewish. It doesn't mean he's not chayiv and mitzvos. But for many halachos, to the extent that we distinguish between Jew and Gentile, this Jew is considered or treated as if they are a Gentile.
Might have been driving to shul.
So hold that thought, actually. That's actually that type of contradiction, which we, some of us, depending on where we grew up, we talked before about how I grew up in Cincinnati. I grew up with people like this, you know, who drive to shul, or who go, or even who walk to shul, but then go home and turn on the TV. So it's a dying breed. It's a...
Private.
it's a dying note, but the idea of the contradiction, or how does the fact that a person goes to shul or makes kiddush but then does whatever, we'll actually get into that, I hope, in a few minutes. But let's now, before we can zoom into the modern era, which I want to get to very much, I want this to be very practical, but we have to take a step back. Where does all this come from? This actually comes from the Gemara. It's harsh, maybe a little bit even politically incorrect, but it's in the Gemara, and it's not debated either. In a few places, let's see the Gemara here. It's an Erevin, Daf Samach Tes. Now, the details would take us too long, and we wouldn't have enough time to do the real important things of this year. But the context here, just for those who know what I'm talking about, great, and if not, don't worry, has to do with Erev Chatzeros. Who counts towards an Erev? Who, if they don't contribute to your Erev, messes you up? Details in Masechta Erevin. It's a plug for Daf Yomi, because that's most people wouldn't know about it unless they learned Daf Yomi. Anyway, so the Gemara tells the story, or tells the halacha in the name of Rav Huna, that not only if you're living in a chatzer, you're sharing a neighborhood or a courtyard with a Gentile, are there certain dinim, but not only is that, if it's a Gentile, what if one of your neighbors is a Mechalal Shabbos Befarhesia? That also is a problem, says the Gemara, because Chamira Alei Shabbos Avodah Zarah. Because we view it as tantamount to idolatry. Now, why is that? The Gemara doesn't explain. It's such a huge leap. Yes, especially for a modern temperament, we can all relate to and understand why a person wouldn't keep Shabbos, but we can't even fathom why a person would worship Avodah Zarah. Just because a person does this, he's bowing down to idols. So Rashi, there's a very famous Rashi which points out something which you've probably actually heard in one form or another, but one of the earliest sources of this idea is actually our Rashi. In Masechta Chulin, why is it doing Masechta Chulin? Because it has to do with who is eligible to be a shochet. And even if you have the most perfect technique and the perfect knife, but if you are disqualified as an individual, then your shechita is no good. And one of the people who is disqualified from shechita is a Mechalal Shabbos Befarhesia. So Rashi says, why? Well, maybe I'm the perfect shechit. I just happen to, enjoy driving on Shabbos. Doesn't work. Why, says Rashi? Da'oved ovedes kochavim kofer ba'kadosh baruch hu. Someone who worships Avodah Zarah, it's tantamount to denying God. Complete heresy. Hamachalel Shabbos, kofer b'masov, umeid sheker shelosh shavas hakadosh baruch hu b'masav reishis. Very fascinating. You could believe in God, but by machalel Shabbos, whether you realize it or not, again, no one is saying that the average person has it in their mind, but it doesn't matter. There's an objective reality here. By machalel Shabbos, you're not necessarily contradicting the existence of God. You may very well believe in God. But what did Rashi say very carefully? Your kofer b'ma'asav. What you see from this Rashi, very profound with many ramifications, well beyond tonight's topic, is that it's not enough just to believe in God, but it's also b'ma'asav. There's a narrative. Part of our belief in God, indivisible, is that He is the author of the creation story. We also know from the Aser HaDibros and from Kiddush every Friday night, from davening, that it's also part of that belief, indivisibly, is that He's the author of the Exodus. Zecher Litzias Mitzrayim and Zecher L'Maaseh Bereishis. Those two things, and here we're simply talking about creation, from our perspective, are indivisible theologically from His existence. To separate those two make it completely irrelevant that He exists. So therefore, by someone working and not giving, in essence, testimony that you believe that God created the world, that is tantamount, whether even if you believe you, if you say, but I believe in Him, we're not denying that. We don't think you're lying, you're not tricking us. We take it at your word, but it's irrelevant. Belief in a God without a belief that He was the creator is irrelevant. Makes God irrelevant, and therefore irrelevant. Therefore, says Rashi, that's where we have this chumrah, which has many ramifications, including, said the Mishnah Berurah, counting towards a minyan. And many poskim, not all, but many, many poskim agree with this. Josh before asked me, well, the Mishnah Berurah quoted it, does that mean he agrees with it? Yes, but not only the Mishnah Berurah. Before the Mishnah Berurah was the Netziv. Netziv was a relatively open-minded, moderate type. The Netziv felt, in Mechal Shabbos Farhesia, you do not count for a minyan.
But do they make a distinction between those that make an affirmative decision, you know what, I'm going to be Mechal Shabbos, and those who grew up knowing very little and don't realize?
That's the next part of the shir. Perfect segue. You should host this one day. Maybe you should organize a shir or something. You're just, you're zeroed in there, Jared. So, not only is the Netziv, the Mishnah Berurah, the Prima Gadim, But the Mincha Saluzer, the Munkacher, anyone here get Mishpacha magazine? If you get Mishpacha magazine, maybe you read in last week, they had an unbelievable story about these 9 minutes of film, which I saw on the internet like a year ago or something. It was discovered the Munkacher Rebbe had a daughter, and there was some American film company that took a movie of this unbelievable wedding in Munkach before the war, and somehow they convinced the Rebbe. They said, Rebbe, say something to American Jews. And he gave this very heart-wrenching, profound thing, begging Jews to do what? Jews of America, he said, keep the Sabbath. And sure enough, you know, as again, well before my time, but maybe some around people around the table may recall, but there was a time in America where you'd go to a movie, and before the movie they had news and things, you know, on the reel. So there was a time, I don't exactly remember the date, 1920-something, 30-something, you can check the Mishpacha magazine or other, you can look it up online. There was a time in America where this reel of the Munkacher Rebbe at the it was tremendously royal, and it would put the British to shame, how the pageantry and the royal, you know, of this wedding, but he's there giving this muster to American Jewry, keep Shabbos. So that's the Munkacher. So he was a passionate person. We might call him a kanai about things he believed in. And the Munkacher also felt, like the Mishneh Berurah, like the Netziv, who was very different, but the Netziv also, that a Machal Shabbos cannot count towards the minyan. So that's another big carve out. But now I want to get to, and this is really a very important focus now, and we'll spend a good 10-15 minutes now on this, is the question of whether this is always true. Jeremy phrased the question, I think, very well. Is this punishment? Is this a statement of responsibility? Is this just saying, listen, you know, Nebuch, you know, you may not be, you know, you don't believe, you just can't. Are there any limits to this, or is this really ironclad? Because obviously, the world in which we currently live in, what is it, 90% of Jews are? I mean, it's, it's a lot more than 50%. So are we really saying, again, not that they can't come to our shuls and not none of that, but that they can't count towards the minyan, they're really all excluded? So this has been a heart-wrenching question since the early and mid part of the 19th century. It's not, it's modern, but not new. And the earliest focus on this, and I would say a, not like consequential, does not do it justice, a pivotal paradigm shift comes from the tshuva on the bottom of your page from Rav Yaakov Ettlinger.
Question. Whatever happens to the rules of the Gemara goes into so much detail and so such refinements before somebody can be considered a Navarian of a given thing. Yet they have Atra'ah, yet they have Edim.
Good.
They have so all these things. And if not, you don't have these prerequisites,
good,
then he's not considered to be this Avarian that you're talking about.
Well, it's a good question. There's a two-part answer. Almost all poskim and one posik. What I mean to say, if you turn over your sheet for a second, look at the second sheet. In the middle of the big source, which I hope to get to in a few minutes, in the middle of that big source of the Malamed Oil, you see at the end of the first line, I have it bolded, Shut Mahari Asad. See that? You see the Mahari Asad? So that source, which I actually have underlined, look at the second line. Kol ze shel hu'idu aleihem b'fneihem b'fnei bezin shechalu b'fnei yud me'yisrael ein osrun yayin b'ma'ga'am, etc., etc. The Mahari Asad, who was a Talmud of the Chassam Sofer, so he was living in this turbulent period, he felt exactly as you did. He said, in the world which we, he's not suggesting this was always should have been the case, but he says, in the world which we live in his time already, certainly Kal Vachomer in our time, the only way we would exclude somebody or give him the status of Machal Shabbos Dinuk Akum, which has ramifications for minyan, for shechita, for touching wine, for many halachos, he says, is only if we had exactly the same. We had bona fide witnesses come and give us testimony. We saw this person to be Machal Shabbos in public, but short of that, he agrees with you. These halachas will not apply. That is his opinion, and Baruch Shekhi Vanta to that opinion. Virtually everyone else in the world disagrees. But Nebuch, I want to be like Rav Leib Yitzchak, I want to defend everybody else. How come everyone else disagrees? Why does everyone else disagree? The reason is because those halachos about witnesses and all that, that would be if we were going to give a juridic punishment. If the Beit Din was going to punish, we would not punish a person without Eidus. But this is not about punishing them. This is about whether we can rely on them to say a davar sheva gusha. And you don't need formal testimony for that, at least according to most opinions. So that's, I think, the easy answer. But you're right, it's a good point, because Mahari Asad actually agreed with you. So let's take a look at the bottom of the first sheet. Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, he died in the early to mid part of the 19th century. He was Gadol Hador in Germany, but as I say, I give you the German reference just so you should know where he lived and did his work, but I wouldn't limit it. He was Gadol Hador everywhere. But he was in the forefront of the changing world and the battle for tradition that was going on in Germany in his time. And he was asked a shaila, and he's very unclear, he's not sure what to do. And the person who asked him the question assumed that a person who keeps his store open on Shabbos, who goes to work on Shabbos, that we throw the book at him. Dino ka'akum, therefore he can't be a shochet, and all those things. So he says on the second line that 100%, me'ikr hadin, letter of the law, you're unquestionably correct. Like we see subsequently from the Mishnah Berurah, etc. Achal Shabbos b'parhesia, it's a din in the Gemara, you're right. But he says, look at this line. Unbelievable. Here's where everything turns. Aval leposhei Yisrael shebizmaneinu. But the sinners, those people who are not loyal and faithful in our generation, lo yadana ma'adun behem. Because I just don't know. Could we really have the same harsh attitude towards them as we've had in previous generations? Achar sheb avanoseinu harabim, given Nebuch our great sins, Poshta habaheres l'rov am sheberubam. It's more than a majority already. Chilol Shabbos nasek etter. They don't even think they're doing anything wrong. They think it's already mutter. It's totally permissible. So he wonders. He's confused. And then he adds on the next line, yesh behem, not all of them, but some of them. This is what was mentioned before. You mentioned about going to shul and the like. Yesh behem shemit balim tefillah Shabbos u'mekachim kiddush hayom. They go to shul. They come home, they make Kiddush, they have the Shabbos meal, and then they go to work, and they turn on the TV. Well, I guess they didn't turn on the TV in his day, but you know what I mean?
Radio.
So, Achar Kach Mitzpalim Shabbos. So he says, I don't understand. He goes, on the one hand, by the Michal Shabbos, that shows they don't believe. And yet, he looked two lines later, but he says, but yet they do Kiddush, they daven. But they're acknowledging, oh, they're not going through the motions. Who are they davening to? Who are they making Kiddush to? They understand the Shabbos is different. It's complex. And then he adds the second point that Jeremy had mentioned. What about the next generation? He's talking even in the first generation. What about the second generation? Uma gam bibnehem asher kamu tachten, the children, the next generation, shalo yodu v'lo shamu dinei Shabbos. They don't know anything. It's not their fault. It's just the way they were raised. Their mamash like tzedukim, shalo nechshu v'kumumara in avo pisha mechal in Shabbos. They're just following the way they were raised. Isn't that what we all want from our kids? What, you think only Shomer Shabbat people want their kids to follow them? They also have values, also teach them things. It's just not things we believe in. But they listen to their parents, just like we listen hopefully to our parents. Harbe me poshe hador domin lahem. He gives a historical analogy like the Karoyim, which we'll get back to, and he says that maybe the modern day reformers in his day, 19th century, maybe they're even better. He ends off his tshuva, though, despite this, still a little bit confused. And he says, basically, he's equivocal. He says, someone who wants to be machmir and to treat, let's say a person had wine, not mevushal, beautiful, delicious German wine, and your non-religious neighbor touched it. Are you still allowed to drink that wine or not? So he says, if you want to be machmir, he says, I hear you, tova la bracha. But he says, achein gam lemekilim yesh lemahmi shiyismachu. Someone who was lenient in this case, he says, I could hear it. Again, this is such an important tshuva. Again, just, he's not writing on the sidelines. He's not writing a retrospective. He is living in the middle of a turbulent period of history. And he senses that things are changing. But again, this is all part of so much of what we do in halacha, which is, you know, how do you stay current? Halava, you know, we always complain the rabbis should be more forward-thinking. Okay, let's be forward-thinking too and current. And yet, but we're living a world, we're living a life which is totally anchored in the past. That is not a simple thing. You know, easy to be an armchair quarterback, but it is not a simple thing to be the one who has to make these decisions, especially in real time. And you see, on a human level, I just have so much admiration. You know, for someone who was, you know, he was the Gadol Hador, and that was the generation he was living in, and he's struggling with this. and he's not willing, and I can understand why, and it was so it was shocking to him. We take it for granted. What we take for granted was a shock to their system. Nevuch. It would be better if we were still a little bit more shocked, maybe. But we're not, because we're human. And this is what's all around us. But he's not willing to just completely change the halacha in that sense. But he's had his famous lines of Yesh al mi lismoch have reverberated. And poskim throughout the 19th and 20th century in Europe, America, and Israel have basically more or less adopted what was for him only a tentative conclusion. They have more or less enshrined as accepted halacha. And what's interesting, and I just want to call your attention before we see some more modern tshuvas in a moment, but even though he was dealing with something new, it is worth noting, as Shlomo Melech taught us, Ein Chadash Tachas HaShemesh, it wasn't unprecedented, because there have been other upheavals in Jewish history, and one of the most controversial and impactful, which was, you saw already alluded to, was the Karaim. I think there are still a few Tzibori Karaim even in Israel nowadays, right? There are some. I don't know where they are, but Ramlar, I don't remember. Somebody told me where they are. Anyway, Chalon is some Karaim. Anyway, yeah, so we know.
Different
groups.
You say bells, I say bubble, but you know. Hard to keep track. Anyway, the Karaim, as we know, infamously believed in Torah Shebichtav, but not Torah Shebaalpeh. They did not accept the oral tradition, and therefore, as we've seen alluded to, they were written out of Judaism. We were written out of Judaism. The Rambam, very famously, in the next source, the Rambam in Hilchos Mamrim, talks about many, many, many harsh halachos. Forget not counting for a minyan. Gemara speaks about, you want to talk about politically incorrect, the Gemara speaks about a case where somebody falls into a pit, and basically if you don't, you know, make a rescue operation, they will die. Says the Gemara about certain people, Moridin ve'eino malin, let them die. And the Rambam says that includes the Karaim, people who have you're heretics. Yet, says the Rambam in this very famous quote, Mamrim Perek Gimel Halacha Gimel, V'meh Dvar Mamurim, what are we talking about? This speaks to Jeremy's point a few moments ago. Beish shekafar b'Torah shebaal peh b'machshavto u'b'dvarim shiniru lo v'halachar da'ato hakala v'achrei shirut libo v'kofar b'Torah shebaal peh t'chila k'tarak b'baitus, etc. This is someone who had a conscious and informed decision, who had opportunity to know better, who did know better, and then chose a different path. So for that person, they are responsible for their decisions and for their actions, and we throw the book at them. Aval b'nei ha'tovim ha'ilu, but their children, ubnei b'neim, and their grandchildren, shiducho osam avosam v'noldu ben akaroyim v'gidlu osam al da'atam, they're raised with the philosophies and the beliefs of their parents, harihu ketinok, the famous quote, the famous phrase, harihu ketinok shenishba b'neihem. It's as if, you know, some monastery kidnapped and ran off with a child, and they're raised completely around non-Jews. So somebody who's kidnapped and brought up in a monastery, you can expect them to know what Shabbos is? You're going to hold them accountable because they drive on Shabbos? Of course not. So the Rambam's jump. Here, they're not, what do you mean? Here, they're living in a Jewish community. They're all Karaim. They're all Jews. Says the Rambam, but that's equivalent. The second generation doesn't know any better. As I said before, every community, some have more successful lessons. We all have things we believe in. We all try to pass it on to our children. That's part of the human condition. So the Karaim were no different. And like in most cultures, most kids will follow their parents. Not all, but most do. More or less. So most children of the Karaim don't really have a fighting chance. So the Rambam says that you have to have rachmanis. You're right. You cannot hold them. One second, please. You cannot hold them accountable. Again, it's not allowed. It's not permissible to do the things that they do, believe the things they do. But we don't have these extra stringencies. We have more rachmanis on the children than we do on the parents. And then he adds something very important. Very, very important. Look at the fourth line in the middle of the line. V'af al pi sheshama acharkach. Sheyu Yehudi v'ra Yehudim v'datam harehu ka'onos sharei gidluhu al ta'otam. Let's say this person is brought up completely secular in Wichita, takes a junior year abroad, and he's traveling through the Mideast, and he meets somebody, and they tap him on the shoulder, and they convince him even to have a Friday night meal in the old city, and even go to the Discovery Seminar, and then it ends the way most of these stories end. He's just as secular as he was before. And not the 2% who actually that make videos on ish.com. The 98% who unfortunately didn't know. So says the Rambam, are you going to now throw the book at him? You'll say, well, when he was just growing up in Wichita, he didn't know better, but now he's been exposed to the truth, and he's rejecting it, so we should condemn him. Says the Rambam, who are you kidding? Do you know how hard it is to change? Do you know how hard it is to do something differently than your parents raised you? Says the Rambam, you can't hold that against a person. We don't condemn someone who didn't change. The Chiddush is that there's even 2% who do change. That's an amazing thing. To be a Baal Tshuva, in the modern sense of that word, it's mind-boggling to grow up a certain way and then to choose a different path. You can't expect someone to do that. That's a miracle. And therefore, he says, it doesn't matter. Even someone who's exposed, who onus, that's still considered onus, doesn't matter. Kach elu shamarnu ha'ochsim b'darche avosam ha'karayim sh'ta'u. It doesn't matter if you expose them, if you give them a cure of class, when they're 28 or when they're 38, halavai, it will work, you should try. But just because it didn't work, does not mean that all of a sudden they're responsible the way their parents or grandparents were. Because we are so affected by our girsa de yankusa, by our childhood, by influences that we had growing up. Not everyone agrees with that last point, by the way. You should just know Rabbeinu Tam is quoted by the Nemuka Yosef, who says that once a person, even if he's a child of a karai or a tzeduki, once he meets Jews and he interacts with them and he's been exposed to them, then if he still rejects Torah, then we throw the book at him. But that's explicitly against this Rambam. But it is part of the debate nowadays. There's a posek who passed away not long ago, Rav Binyamin Zilber from Bnei Brak, a big tzaddik. So he writes that he thinks also, based on not the Rambam, but the other opinions, that maybe in Chutz La'aretz, in the diaspora, so that's total rampant assimilation, you can't blame anybody. But someone who's growing up in Israel, where they're surrounded by Torah and from Jews, so you'll forgive me, and Rav Binyamin Zilber should forgive me, but I have to be honest with you, what I was reading, you know what I was thinking when I read that tshuva?
Yeah.
That's
right?
I could only cry. It's not a joking matter. It's just a tragedy. But if you tell me that somebody who grew up exposed to some of the things that we know about that go on, especially in this country, that everybody's more responsible for not wanting to be from, Adaraba. If he grew up in Wichita, he'd have a much better chance. It reminds me of something Dr. Abraham Tversky once said at a famous AJOP convention. He started off his speech by saying, I always wonder, if I wasn't from, but knew about the Orthodox community, would I, Dr. Tversky, know about the Orthodox community? Where I want to be from? A very heart-wrenching question. We are not perfect. And there's a lot that we do that drive people away. We have to be honest about that. So I don't want to get on a digression. There's many things that about the community that are wonderful, which do attract people. That's why they're Baruch Hashem or Baal Tshuva, etc. But anyway, all of this, in my opinion, anyway, is academic. The Rambam is very clear that it doesn't matter. Again, not that we don't want people to become Baal Tshuva. Of course we do. But that once you're raised that way, there's a certain built-in assumption that it's going to be very hard to overcome that, whatever you think about whether it's good or not to be exposed to the things we're exposed to in the Holy Land.
Is the Rambam talking about counting them in a minion here?
He's speaking in general. No, he wasn't talking about the minion at all. But he's talking about the more fundamental question of dinok akum. The minion is a result of that, and many other shilas are a result of that. And I just want to mention quickly, because we have about 10 more minutes left, that this, as I say, this idea, which goes back to the Rambam, I said it was in Germany, it was not unprecedented, even though they were living in a new reality. It has then been endorsed, as I said, and become kind of more mainstream halacha. And the second most famous source on this topic was written about 50 years after that by the Melamed Lohoyel, the next source on your sheet, who was, you could say in a certain unofficial sense, Rav Yaakov Edlinger's successor as Gadol Hador in Germany. This is Rav David C. Hoffman. He died in the early part of the 20th century. He lived into the 20th century. And he was a very consequential posek as well. And he also basically takes that next step in this next generation to speak about it. And he points out, here he's talking a little bit about minyan. If you look in the first part of the tshuva, I won't read it inside, but he talks about the fact that on the books, they shouldn't be able to be chazanim, they shouldn't be able to count for a minyan. He goes, then I came to a shul, he goes, I came to a very frum shul. And they were counting the person for a minyan. So here you learn a musser. He didn't start screaming. He didn't start making wild, obscene noises. He waited, and politely afterwards, he asked the gabbai, what's going on, my high? So the gabbai told him, there's always been our minog, not only us, also by the Ungarish, also by the Hungarians. You see already, even in Rav Yaakov Edlinger's tshuva, the Hungarians are always considered something different. I think here, I'm not joking, he says, afilu in the Hungarian, I think he means more machmir. Right? The Hungarians, whatever, I don't want to say anymore, I'm Polish. Polish and proud.
What about kiruv?
It's important, but not relevant to this. I'm being serious. Kiruv is wonderful, but the question is, how do we deal with the people who aren't from? So you can try to mekarev them. I think I've said a few times, of course we should try to mekarev them. But the question is, in the meantime, do they count for a minyan? We're discussing halavai, they should all, everyone should become from. Wonderful. But in the meantime, if they're not, right, we have to live in the real world. What's the status? You know, we're trying to ask, I think it's a very important question, but admittedly, a limited question. There's many other, I can give a lecture, you know, this is not a series in how to relate to the non-Orthodox. There's many other topics in that umbrella. This is a very specific, I think important, but a very specific question. He adds something which I think will be interest to all of us, given our backgrounds. If we take a look, about 60% of the way down, if you will, where I have it bolded in the middle, you see the words Shoel Umeshiv. So he writes that after he did this investigation, he heard, oh my God, in Germany they're doing this, even in Hungary they're doing it. He then, somebody who he trusts told him a report about the Shoel Umeshiv, that's Rabbi Yosef Shoel Natanson, who is the Rav of Lvov, also one of the great, great Gedolim, who wrote, quote, Shahanoshim Mei America. This is a historical source. Because you know, what did European Jewry think of America? Gayesha Bagayesha. Golden and Gayesha. They thought every brick was gold smeared with chazer. You know, how many Jews who could have gotten out of Europe, but the choice was America, and they figured going to America is like shmad. Rather die a Jew in Europe than live as a guy in America. This was the mentality, because you got on the boat, you threw off your tefillin. This is why people went to America. So he says here, you have the Gadol Hador of Yosef Shoel Natanson, the Shoel Umeshiv, basically saying the entire America is one big Tinok Shenishba. Now, not only is it an important historical insight, but it also gives you a certain sense of chizuk, of pride. Could he have imagined the Torah Renaissance that occurred in America? Could the Jews of the 19th century have imagined what would happen in the mid 20th century? It's amazing. That's what America was. He wasn't, you know, extreme. That was a realistic assessment of America in the end of the 19th century. 50, 60 years later, after the Holocaust, all of a sudden, for two generations, the home of Torah was America. As good as that is, we now live in an even better world, where the clear home of Torah is Israel. But in the 1940s and 50s, the home of Torah was America. Now, clearly things have changed. Clearly. Mostly for good, but not all. But clearly, Israel has become the dominant driver of the Jewish people now. But America had a renaissance, which could not have been anticipated. Araya, Shoel Umeshiv, did not have Nevuah. How could he have anticipated that? So the whole America was one big Tinok Shenishba. This idea is accepted in terms of the leniency. Not only by here, the Lama Lahoyel and the Shoel Umeshiv, and Rav Moshe Feitzin has a tshuva about this. Rav Chaim Ozer, the Gadol Hador of Lithuania and Vilna, who died at the early part of the World War II, he has a tshuva three times, I think, where he quotes this and accepts it. Take a look at the next verse, Heichal Yitzchak, of Herzog, the first chief rabbi of the State of Israel. He writes very strongly, again, each chumrah is a kula, each kula is a chumrah. He writes very strongly against the culture that was permeating Israel in the 1940s. He writes, in our generation, Chilul Shabbos is so rampant. It's a terrible thing. People have completely forgotten that it's even Aser. And he quotes again, where does it all go back to? The Binyan Sion. So what the Binyan Sion, Rebecca Vetlinger, wrote in the late 1800s as a tentative possibility, living in real time on the front row seats of history, 50, 60 years later, Chief Rabbi of Israel just takes as a given. And then he adds, just in very poetic, strong language. And again, Rav Herzog, I can tell you this, Rav Herzog, you know, was known as relatively moderate, certainly his temperament, wasn't an extremist. What does Rav Herzog write? Shezar mehakfira mar'ilim es ha'avir. Right? It's like a poison in the air, this heresy. Yesh le yaches le mechalim b'mida yedua ke'el cholim b'nishmasa machmas shepogu b'hem hachidakim. You've been here 40 years, what are chidakim? Bacteria. There's a spiritual bacteria in the air. How could you be condemning and, you know, harshly judgmental about people who aren't Shomer Shabbos, who are chiloni? He says they breathe in the air, they get bacteria. This is so rampant and so widespread. This is something, there's a letter, I didn't put it in here because I didn't have access to it in the Hebrew, but I saw an English write-up of a shiur a number of years ago from Rav Amital, Zatzal, and he quoted that Rav Kook has a letter about this. There's very famous pieces, which I didn't put on the sheet because they weren't about Minyan per se, but the Chazon Ish has a three very famous pieces about this also, where the Chazon Ish writes that we have to have a completely different attitude nowadays. Instead of this Moridin Vino Ma'alin, the harsh stuff, he says we have to look at our other fellow Jews, Ba'avosos Ha'ava, with bounds of love. But even before the Chazon Ish, Rav Kook said the same thing. He has a letter in Igrot HaRiyah, which I did not see inside, Rav Amital quoted, where he's not speaking about Minyan or anything per se, but he's speaking about the general point. And his idea was, Rav Kook even was pushing it almost, it seems like, even if you weren't from a non from home. But the zeitgeist was so overwhelming. And you, every now and then, there are areas of the country or periods of history where even if you grew up from, but it's like it's a miracle to stay from. Certainly was a time like that in America, maybe in certain places, certain times in Israel. And Rav Kook writes, you can't, again, it's not mutter. Of course, and Rav Kook himself tried as much as he could, traveling over the Yerushalayim and Sonnenfeld up north to the kibbutzim, and of course he tried. But would you throw the book at someone who couldn't make it? So that's what Rav Herzog's saying here. How could you, we don't want them to do it, we try. But how could you blame someone who falls short? It's just in the air. It's overwhelming. Again, we're living in a world, even though the numbers are still so overwhelming, unfortunately, but again, Judaism, and certainly Orthodox Judaism in America, certainly in Israel, is so much ascendant now. We're living in there was just an article, a secular study done that basically the drivers of all Jewish growth in New York now are the Orthodox, and in Israel, I mean, we all know, again, the pluses and minuses of that. Every growth has good and bad things. But the point is, if you only know about what's going on now, you can't imagine what other periods of history have been like. And Rav Herzog wasn't speaking about another world. He's speaking about 50 years ago in Israel, 60 years ago in Israel. And again, certain parts of Israel maybe even still true. Where you can't hold it against someone. There's just no chance. It's a miracle to come out of certain situations from. And we have to be aware of that. Again, so often there's this, sometimes it's a criticism, but I would say in a better way, there should be hopefully an expectation. We want the rabbis, they shouldn't be, in the ivory tower. They should be knowing what's going on in the world. And the answer is yes, they have to know. And here's a perfect example of a case where you have, as Rav Yaakov Ellinger said, Mi'ikar Hadin, if you're just going at the letter of law, if you don't know what was going on in the world, just in the Dalet Amos of the Beis Medrash, there's one halacha. But then the postgame, again, there's the first run of history, and then there's the next generation, but as you see things changing, the psak changed as well. The halacha didn't change, the principle didn't change, but it had to be applied in what turned out to be, in this case, you could say, a more liberal way. I just want to end with something which is even more heart-wrenching and poignant, and just I throw it out for you to think about, which is, what about intermarriage? So we've just mapped, very briefly, in a thumbnail sketch, we just mapped the history of Chil Shabbos. What about the history of intermarriage? So if you look at the last two sources on your sheet, these are tshuvas from the mid part of the 20th century that dealt with counting an intermarried man for a minyan. Can he count? 9 men and the intermarried man. Can he count? So both of these sources, the Minchas Yitzchak, who was one kind of temperament, he wrote this tshuva when he was living in Manchester, but he of course became the head of the Eda Charedit. Okay, fine, you'll say. But also the Sri Yesh, the modern, quote-unquote, Sri Yesh, right? From Germany, Hildesheimer Seminary, then in Switzerland, famous tshuvas about Kolisha and different things. He agrees, they both say the same thing, that whatever you'll say about Chil Shabbos, nebuch that, but intermarriage, you can't count a person who's intermarried for a minyan. And he points out on the bottom, the Minchas Yitzchak, something which I think is something we have to think about. He says, until now, why do we have this more lenient stance towards Chil Shabbos? Because we said second generation, third generation, people don't know any better. Doesn't make it permitted, but we can't blame them for it. That's up to the Rabbanu Shlomo. But in this world, we can't be judgmental considering they don't know any better. But says the Mechazitzik at the bottom of the tshuva, he says, when it came to that, then we said, okay, Nechshav Ketzas Ketirok Shenishba Ochiyotzeva. We can't blame them. But he says, Lo Shayach Linyan Yisuye Nachris, to marry in a marriage, Ein Rov Yisrael Nashalim B'zeh. He says, most Jews know that they can't do that. So I ask you, I don't have a definitive answer. Is that still true?
No.
The ones that are coming third generation of their great.
They've spoken about 20 years or so, they've been speaking about the intermarried rate of being 50% in America. It's a complete misnomer. That's just as accurate as the unemployment rate numbers. Why? Because the 50% intermarriage rate is including Williamsburg, and it's including Borough Park, and it's including Teaneck, and it's including, you know, Beverlywood, and it's including Woodmere and Cedarhurst. If you would take away the firm community in this non-Orthodox community, I have no doubt it's at least 70%, probably more.
Yeah.
It's only 50% when you add Monroe and Square Town and Borough Park and Lakewood, then it gets down to 50%. So could you really still say, now again, it could be, I think the answer is probably it's on a case-by-case basis. There probably are Jews, even if they're not Orthodox, who grow up, you know, knowing, you know, my bubby will never talk to me again, my mother will never talk to me, I know what the right thing is, and then marry out, and maybe you would treat them one way. But there's no question, as I said, I was in Cincinnati, Ohio, there were certainly plenty of Jews. Marrying a non-Jew was only the natural thing to do. It would just be dumb luck if on college campus they met a Jewish girl. But nothing more than luck. But they don't see it in any way as rebellious. It's nasis lo keheter. So I'm not of the authority to make such a psak, but could be that that would be room for a big leniency. I mean, it would be shechil Hashem, though. Maybe you can't bring, I can't bring ourselves to do it. I don't know. Emotionally, it'd be traumatic. You know, because for so long, this was like a red line, you know, of Jewish identity and the like. And but again, it could be. Again, it's not for somebody like me to say, but I raised the question, might that halacha one day also have to be reevaluated? I don't know. But of course, we pray for the kiruv, we pray that everyone should have a heshev levavos albanim, then this will all be academic. But until that tikkun comes, then we have to live in the real world, and in the real world, we have from Jews and we have non-from Jews, and we have to have good relationships with people, but we also have to know where the lines have to be drawn, and this limited, but I think important topic should be seen in that light. Okay, good Shabbos. Can I ask a question?